Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
I do my show on the Heritage Radio Network because I think it's important to talk about the impact of technology on our lives.
I do my show to reach home cooks and help them do better.
I love getting together with people in the industry.
I like hosting my show because, to me, it's the stories about people and their relationship to food that help make the food more interesting and more delicious.
Our hosts do their shows as a labor of love, but we still need your financial support in order to keep the lights on and keep the tape rolling. Please become a member today at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. I am recording from Soho, in the heart of what might be one of the more beautiful buildings that I have seen in a long time with the Hart brothers. You introduce yourselves?
Yeah, I'm Sam Hart. Nice to have you here.
And I'm Sam's brother, Eddie Hart.
And you are the proprietors of where I came to know you as Barrafina, but of so much more. What would be great is to kind of go back to the beginning, to where it started, from your parents, who equally have their own high regards in the cooking industry as well.
Yeah, so our dad is a hotelier and restaurateur, so he started life as a banker, and at the age of about 30, gave up banking and opened a country house hotel.
How did that go over?
Well, he was fed up with banking and city life as well.
Yeah.
He liked the idea of going to the countryside and you know, a change of pace, and he thought it'd be nice and relaxing to open a hotel, which would give him lots of time to, you know, ride a horse and do other stuff.
So no F&B experience.
Absolutely no F&B experience at all, apart from he had eaten quite well.
Okay.
So he was always interested in food and wine.
Okay.
And he probably stayed in a few decent hotels as well, so he knew a little bit, but from a customer point of view. So this was in 1982.
Mm.
And he opened Hambleton Hall, which is still there now, which is a small country house. It has 19 rooms.
Mm.
I think it's now actually the longest continuous holding Michelin-style restaurant in the country. I've had one for something like 33 years.
That's incredible.
A long time.
And are your parents still involved with the day-to-day operations?
Yes, Dad is you know, at the hotel, you know, almost every day. And in fact, then he has a hotel and restaurant in Nottingham as well, mm. And has recently embarked on a kind of real passion of his and opened a bakery and has various bakery shops in and around Rutland, which is the county where the hotel is. But Mum was pretty terrified when he suddenly announced that he was going to open a hotel in the countryside through kind of lack of practical experience. But so you know, I imagine the early days it might have been slightly faulty towers like. But Dad, you know, Dad is, you know, is a real one for just sticking at something and learning about it and you know, keep going until he gets it right.
And how do you feel that influenced the two of you? And I know we'll get to your other brother, who has kind of followed a similar path to your father. But for the two of you, like, was it just always going to be hospitality? Was it just not the family business? Or how did that influence you and your kind of, like, pursuits of where you are now?
So we were sort of different. I always grew up saying I was never going to have anything to do with hospitality at all and came to it slightly by mistake. But Eddie was slightly different and worked from quite an early age through all the departments.
And, you know, and home life, you know, Mum was always a fantastic, and is, a fantastic cook. So even at home, you know, food was a major part of our lives. And Mum had grown up in Mallorca, in the Balearic Islands. And so, you know, when our friends were serving up, you know, tomato ketchup sandwiches and wagon wheels, we were having kind of, you know, roasted red peppers, aubergines, garlic, olive oil, which back in the, you know, I suppose, mid-70s was quite exotic food for, you know, the English countryside. And, you know, and our parents entertained a lot. You know, so I always remember, you know, being sent off to bed, but we were allowed to stay up if we, you know, help, you know, serve drinks to my parents' friends, mix a whiskey, you know, take their friends' coats and hang them up. So, you know, right from a very young age, we were kind of involved in, I suppose, in food and hospitality and, you know, and going to see Dad at work. You know, I remember, you know, hovering in the kitchen doorway, you know, watching all these, you know, chefs in their whites, you know, at work. And, you know, and then our real treat would be a glass of fresh orange juice and a home-baked shortbread biscuit.
So they really knew how to, it was like bed or free labor or like a something, a higher quality ingredient.
You got it.
Yeah, okay. They knew exactly where they had you. So then what kind of brought, so you were hooked from the beginning. So what eventually brought you back in to the fold?
So I left university and was working in finance. I went to help open an office in Mexico City as a money broker.
Yeah.
Hated money broking, but loved Mexico City. And ended up with a friend of mine opening a nightclub. And
what was the name?
It was called El Colmillo, which
okay.
was in something like 2006. So there we did this quite high-end cocktails, very little food, of relatively poor quality, and interesting music. So I suppose that
what
is...
What was the music?
Well, it was mostly underground house, so which we were
perfect.
Keen on. Still are keen on.
Yeah.
So we bought quite a lot of music over from the UK, which at the time was sort of well, if not leading the world, certainly up there. We're producing really interesting stuff to Mexico, where it hadn't really been done very much before. So that was hospitality, but just in a slightly sort of different end of the business.
I mean, it's an early... I mean, nightclub is of a certain ilk, but you still... I mean, both of those customers are super high demanding and usually intoxicated, which is probably not the same as your, say, your breakfast club or maybe your...
It is very... The principles are the same.
Yeah.
You're still trying to give people a good time and make them leave happy. I mean, like you say, one of the worst things about being the nightclub business is your customers are past their prime before they've even got to you. So it's a difficult business, but anyway, so I sort of came in through the back door, as it were.
And I mean, how was running a nightclub for such, I think it was like 15 years, how did that kind of influence the service that you bring here? I mean, what were some of the better lessons that you learned that extended to the current empire?
Well, I was actually there, I was there for 5 years in Mexico with the club, but I suppose that the things we learnt more about was running a small business. You know, obviously, you know, because the bars were the big part of the, you know, where the revenue came from, we were pretty good at running bars and making drinks and cocktails and trying to get that sort of bar service right. You know, I didn't know how to wait a table properly or, organise a three-course meal or anything. But it was a sort of, you know, fringe learning.
So while he was on this track, what track did you take?
I left school and immediately went to work for my dad at Hamilton. So I was 18, and in fact, dad reproduced my contract from when I first started.
Was it still for like not going to bed early?
Criminal pay.
Okay.
And I remember it said hours, you know, as required.
Oh.
But I loved it, and you know, I found it very difficult to focus on kind of. The academics at school, and it was great. You know, it was brilliant for me to kind of start a job that I loved, and to be, you know, and to be congratulated for the work that I was doing. So, I kind of, you know, really kind of, you know, went to it like a duck to water, and I started in the bar, and then I kind of really kind of did a bit of a tour of all the departments there. So I worked on reception for a bit. I was even a chambermaid for you know a few months. So I went through the hotel and just loved all of it really. And then I went to work for my dad in Nottingham and worked at his restaurant there and set up his private dining for him. And so it was you know, great experience over about 7 years. But actually I took a year out and went to live in Madrid, where I kind of learned to speak Spanish and you know fell in love with the Spanish culture and you know all things Hispanic. I was sitting at my desk one day working for my dad, and I'd talked to Sam over the years about the idea of doing something together, you know, potentially. And Sam had always slightly kind of ridiculed the idea, understandably. And I got a call from Sam one day, and Sam said, "Listen, I'm coming back from Mexico. Or maybe you were in Barcelona."
I was in Barcelona, so on the way back from Mexico, I stopped off in Barcelona to sort of re-Europeanize for a bit, for 6 months, and so, and then really fell in love with Spanish food, obviously, because our mum grew up in Mallorca. We knew quite a bit about Spanish cooking anyway, but sort of was really inspired by the amazing ingredients.
So you both kind of had your own like introduction into Spain, and obviously from your parents as well, just kind of leading back into obviously what comes next. So he called you, and how did the idea come about?
So Sam said, "Well, I'm heading back from Barcelona. Might you consider, should we do something together? Should we think of a joint project?" And originally, I think Sam, you know, still kind of recovering from city life in Mexico.
Yeah.
And I was working for my dad, in the provinces and in the countryside. Thought perhaps we would look at doing something, an English pub in the countryside.
Mm.
And so that was really where we started and what we thought of doing. And actually, kind of Sam's then girlfriend, now wife, my sister-in-law, said, "You're mad. You know, you boys, you go stir crazy in the countryside. You know, you're young. You know, there's always time. You know, go and, grow a beard and keep goats and smoke a pipe. You know, further down the line. But you need to be in London." And actually, I think that was part of it, probably because she definitely didn't want to live in the countryside.
More of a selfish suggestion.
But practical, I think. And so then we started to think of, perhaps what, a concept or, an idea that might work in London. And obviously, we were both were mad about Spanish cooking. And the more we started to think about it, but the more we thought that really good Spanish food wasn't kind of it had started to be done in London. There was a restaurant that was around called Morro, which kind of specialises in Spanish, but slightly North African twist on as well. And so and also didn't we kind of look to the sherry bodegas, and there was a sherry bodega out there who was interested in opening a really quality Spanish restaurant.
Yeah, I've forgotten that. Yeah. I can't remember who it was.
So anyway, so we moved down to London. We rented a tiny office with with a couple of phones in it, and we spent the next 2 years chasing agents in London, trying to kind of persuade landlords, to go and have a look at sites and persuade landlords that they might take us on as tenants, which we never realised kind of quite how difficult that was. If you haven't got a proven track record,
right?
These big rich landlords in the West End, are pretty nervous about taking you on. So that took a long time.
And what was it about the West End that drew you? Kind of the character, the area, the time.
I suppose we always thought that tapas is a high footfall thing.
Yeah.
So it's about energy. It's about lots of people. It's about a long service of people popping in and out throughout an extended period. So it seemed to us then, and I suppose still does now, that really for a tapas restaurant, or of the sort of restaurant we wanted to do, it would have to be very extremely central, or at least with a very high footfall. And the most obvious places for that is in the West End.
Hmm. So first restaurant, you finally convince someone to give you a break, first restaurant, and then kind of how does that lead into Barfina and kind of where we are right now?
When Sam was in Barcelona, he came across a restaurant called Cal Pep, which is still there today, and Sam completely kind of fell in love with this restaurant, and recommended that I go out there and go and have a look at this, at the concept and the style of restaurant, and it's. We were greatly inspired. It was our inspiration for what eventually became, Barrafina here in London. But we thought long and hard about whether London was ready. So this is 2003 for a kind of a no reservations, bar counter, dining offer. And we every time we drew it up, we were kind of tempted to put, the bar counter with the stools, no reservations. But a couple of tables,
right?
And so we didn't feel brave enough, and I think that was probably rightly or wrongly because we felt that London wasn't ready for that, concept or style of restaurant. And also then, I suppose, because of the site that we ended up with, which if we'd had choice, would have never gone for an enormous basement off Charlotte Street.
Right.
By the very nature, it was a basement. We couldn't obviously have no reservations because you can't drag everyone downstairs to be told that you're full or So that it became more. It was Spanish. It was tapas, but it was in a restaurant format.
Yeah.
And then fortunately Fino worked and that people seemed to enjoy the style of food. And I suppose it was 2006, was it, that we then found a site that was suitable for a pure kind of, counter bar.
So Fino was kind of like the bridge between kind of like your kind of original concept to like where you ended up taking bar.
Exactly. It was a slightly watered down version of, which I think was right. So it was 2003.
Yeah.
The tapas restaurants, there weren't really very many, if any, sort of high class ones. And so a lot had changed between 2003 and 2000, whatever it was, 2006, 2007, when we opened Barrafina. The people had got much more used to small plates and sharing, and we thought they were then ready for the full, unwatered down experience of no tables, stools only, no reservations.
We're going to take a quick musical break. We're going to talk about Barrafina and the kind of the beautiful building that we're sitting in and some upcoming semi-secret projects, and we'll be right back.
I I just want to look like someone who is good at everything. The work that you put into it is worth something, they said, but that's just it. It's sort of hard to say what's one thing or the other. Either way, you get exhausted and deflated. Everyone says it's okay, but what do they know? Milestones are overrated. Our souls are paper thin, we're running out of clever thoughts. It's getting old, we are in empty beds, floating down a river all alone. I hate to break it to you, kid, but you are never going home. And still you try and try to find another way. Still you die when they look you in the eye. You wanna climb up on a ledge, tape your last wishes to the fridge. Well, I don't wanna think about it, I don't wanna think about it, I don't wanna think about it, I don't wanna think about it. I should feel ashamed, but somehow I don't feel ashamed. I feel an overwhelming nothing. I feel nauseous and disgusted. Feel lightheaded and estranged from life. Feel lonely and insane. Feel like watching television for eternity until I shrivel up. If God is smiling on you, he must be smiling on me too. Can you admit that makes no sense? Not even for a second. I ask you how you are, you're stressed. Ask about your day, MS. I ask you what you plan. You said you're settling for second best. And still you try and try to find another way. Till you die when they look you in the eye. I know it's hard to hear, but you're the loser of the year. And I don't want to talk about it, I don't want to talk about it, I don't want to talk about it, I don't want to talk about it. You, well, I would run if I was you. Yeah, I would run so far away from me, so far away from me. If I was you, yeah, I would run if I was you. Well, I would run so far away from me, so far away from me. If I was you, well, I would run if I was you. Well, I would run so far away from me, so far away from me, and start again.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market, America's healthiest grocery store with more than 400 locations throughout the United States. Download the Whole Foods Market app on your smartphone for recipes, sales, information, and digital coupons. Or visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store closest to you.
Welcome back. So Barfina opened, there's now three locations. One of the things that is kind of interesting is that it's not the same, very easy to make the same menu at each restaurant, but sourcing obviously plays a big part of your restaurant. So how do you pick what goes where, and you know, what is the relationship that you have to your suppliers?
Well, that's Nieves is in charge of the menus. Mm-hmm. When we first opened Barfina, actually, we were much more involved, you know, with Nieves than we are now about the structure of the menu, the dishes, you know, what was going to be, what's going on. And then Nieves grew in confidence and
when did she join the team?
Well, she started 3 months before we opened Fina.
Oh, okay.
So in late 2002.
So she's been with you through...
She's been through, what's that now, it's 15 years, 14 yeah. years, anyway, a long time. So she now writes the menus. Mm. And when we opened Adelaide Street, which is the second Barrafina, we thought... slightly naively that it was going to be the same menu with one or two changes, a couple of different dishes, and Nieves had been very secretive about what was going on with the menu. And about 2 days before we opened, we said, oh, fine, let's actually have a look at this menu. We looked at it and it was sort of 85% different from the original. It was like, wow. And which wasn't what we were expecting, but actually it's in retrospect really nice, because it means you can go to one Barrafina for one thing and the next day the Barrafina is completely, I mean, the food is stylistically exactly the same,
right?
And it's not like it doesn't share, of course they share, you know, dishes and they share specials and,
right.
And you know, the seasons obviously are the same in all the restaurants, but it is a really nice thing having a different menu in the different restaurants. So because what we didn't want to do is open another thing that just be the same as the last one. What Nieves didn't want to do, because obviously she surprised us with that.
Right.
And with Adelaide Street, with the addition of a kind of charcoal grill, One of these our particular makers, someone called a Josper.
Yeah.
That kind of gave another string to the kind of culinary bow, I suppose, of Adelaide Street. We have one also in Drury Lane, but there's a whole range of fishes, vegetables, meats that are cooked in that charcoal oven that have a stylistic kind of difference.
And the menu is great. The daily specials is also really incredible. I know I mentioned suppliers, but talk about relationships with that. Talk about kind of like you introduced small plate tapas in an early time, like fresh suppliers. Kind of in the relationships. Do you have relationships with people in Spain, local suppliers? How does that work?
Yeah, so we've worked really hard building up our supplier list over the years. The first one we did was, there's a special flour that comes from the south of Spain for frying fish in, which didn't exist in the UK when we started.
What's the name of the flour?
It's called harina especial para freir. Mm. And it's quite a coarse flour. I'm not quite sure how it works. But anyway, the Andalus are the only people that really make it. But no one had it here, so we imported that direct. And I remember the sort of ton of flour arrived before we opened it. It was stashed absolutely everywhere throughout the building.
Every cupboard, every shelf, everything.
And then eventually, I think, one of our other Spanish suppliers imported it for us, and the supply chain got going. But we've worked with loads of people to try and establish direct lines into Spain to get products that weren't available when we got here. So I don't think there was things like milk-fed lamb. When we got here, with Adelaide Street, we managed to get hold of milk-fed lamb's kidneys to take it a step further.
The public was demanding
it. Which is an amazing product, actually. Or we've now worked out someone who will sell us suckling pig's ears, and only the ears, which is quite a weird sort of supply.
That's not.
I think we're the only people that buy that. We've got this amazing guy now, actually in Portugal, who's buying fish for us out in the market there. And we've been, in a way, helped by... the recession in Europe since 2007, whereas a lot of this produce was consumed in its entirety in Spain or Portugal, mm-hmm. wherever it was, and they had no incentive to export it. But with the economic downturn there, suddenly a lot of this really high-end produce was going spare in Spain, and so they were starting to become much more interested in trying to get supply lines into places like the UK. So we've done really well with that. But, at the same time, we also use a lot of local UK suppliers.
And have you found for your suppliers in Spain and Portugal that they have now, through you, found other places in the UK and you were kind of the entry point? Or is it you're mainly just like the one place that will take
So there's a guy who we used to call the man in the van because he drove over from Spain in a very small van. And actually, there was someone else he supplied before us, but anyway, there was two or three restaurants. But he used to come once a month, and now he comes once a week in a huge, sucking great Arctic. And that's not us, there's lots of other people. I think it was very difficult to get even pimientos de padrón when we started. Now you can buy them at Tesco's most weeks, so but things have changed a lot.
But also, Nevis is, I think is... whenever I talk to suppliers, they're terrified of Nieves, but hopefully in a good way. If you can be terrified in a good way, because she's such a stickler for attention to detail, quality, a lot of these suppliers have obviously kind of many clients in London. They're trying to kind of deliver the same quality to everyone, but it's slightly kind of he who shouts loudest.
Yeah.
And I think they're all pretty keen not to upset Nieves. So her box of courgette flowers will be the very best of the bunch and the best pick.
But that also, I think, pushes people to, push the standards. If the crop that year wasn't that good, talk about the soil, talk about rotation, talk about all those things. So, like, a chef of that holds people to that level actually kind of raises the bar for all the people that feed into it. And also the other boxes that are maybe not the best boxes are maybe better than they would have been without them being there.
That's yeah, like... I completely agree. And the supply chains have improved as well. So, for example, like fish. We used to work with these, or we still do work with these guys on the south coast in Brixham. And, before the fish used to go from Brixham, then it'd go to, a market, Billingsgate or wherever. You spend another day hanging around there and then go to the restaurant suppliers, the day after that. So, a lot of the fish suppliers have worked out that actually they can sell direct into the restaurants. Cut out the middleman so the price is better, but also cut a day out of the whole procedure. So you're getting a fish that's then a whole day fresher than it used to be. So these supply lines are improving. They're improving all the time.
That's great. So I want to make sure that we get to Quo Vadis, where we're seated in right now. 1926.
That's right.
Really incredible building, like unbelievable location. If you could just share a little bit of the history of the building itself and who's kind of inhabited it over the years until you took over.
So Quo Vadis, as it stands, actually comprises four buildings. Mm. So 26 to 29 Dean Street. But Peppino Leoni, who was an Italian immigrant, who came over from Lake Maggiore, I think, in the early 20s. He'd worked at the Savoy, I think, at Claridge's, as a waiter, and eventually took up a small bank loan, or probably then quite a big bank loan. It was £700, and bought the lease to number 27 Dean Street.
The freehold.
The freehold, did he?
Yeah.
Good man. impossible to do that now. Anyway, and so he opened a very small restaurant with, I think, seven tables, and struggled, for I think the first couple of years, but eventually kind of managed to kind of grow his business and ended up, buying the adjacent properties. But Quo Vadis, as you see it now, is the four buildings kind of knocked together.
It's about to turn 90. And you have some plans for renovations or anything, but what is the kind of, like, who makes this up? Like, who is the members here, and, what is the kind of vibe of this place?
So we've got the ground floor is a restaurant, which is open to the public. Obviously, the members are on the first and second floor, and then private dining above there. So the membership base, we always wanted to have a very eclectic membership, so that wasn't overly cliquey, that wasn't just the same sort of people, because we think that makes for a slightly dull room if everyone's just from exactly the same backgrounds. But I suppose the sort of things that bind them together is that they tend to work in and around, or at least have a connection with Soho, because if they don't have any connection with Soho, it doesn't really make sense for them to come in here. I suppose a lot of them are in creative industries, whether media, creative industries, but also there's a lot of people who in food and drink, wine, obviously, and a mixture of ages. So we think that's just as interesting to sit next to a 80-year-old man at the bar as it is to sit next to the 20-year-old, because they've both got different things to offer. But I suppose the thing we really like is that they should be open-minded and interesting and eclectic.
One of the things that's interesting about the renovations is that you're moving Barrafina into the building, which is a difficult concept sometimes to take something that is so established and beloved. And, I mean, the room is just as much as part of the meaning. So, like, what kind of thinking goes into that, or what do you feel you need to be cognizant and wary of moving something into a new place?
Well, we were forced into a position for having to look for kind of new premises for Barrafina on Frith Street. And our landlord is refurbishing the entire building, which would require us to kind of be out of the building and not operating there for 2 years. And so we started to look around, and obviously this was a real blow to us. Frith Street has a fantastic business and was the original Barrafina, and we started scratching our head. And Jeremy Lee, who is the head chef here at Quo Vadis and also our partner, and we sat down and discussed it, and we felt that with the addition of a kind of a members restaurant up on the first floor here at Quo Vadis, that we could downscale the restaurant on the ground floor open to the public, and and welcome Barrafina in.
And the great thing is I suppose that the that we're their sister restaurants,
right?
So we work closely together anyway, and we think that Barrafina will actually bring a really amazing sort of shot of energy into Quo Vadis. Quo Vadis has always evolved over the years. First it was one building, then it was two, then it was three, then it was four, then it was Marco Pierre White, then it was us. We started off as British cooking, but cooked by a Frenchman, and then we had Jeremy. So Quo Vadis has had a long and evolving history. And, it is a change for the building, but it will still look the same, it will still feel the same. And we think that Barrafina actually adds an extra string to its bow, brings this, ushers in a great new decade for us.
And speaking onto the future, things that you can and cannot talk about, just in one sentence each, give me your thought on tacos.
Yeah, so tacos is very exciting. As you know, I lived in Mexico City.
Yeah.
So I've been talking about doing tacos for about 15 years and completely failed to do anything about it. But eventually, with our youngest brother, you briefly mentioned earlier. Yeah.
Who has left financial
industries. He's left the financial industries.
Yeah, just like Dad.
Exactly. And come to join us full time. We've got another you know, partner on board with the energy and also with my ex-partner from Mexico, Crispin Somerville. So we've got now the people and the team required to get the tacos up and running. And we're very excited about it.
And what is the current state of tacos in London?
I mean,
it exists, but is it of a quality?
It exists, but it's a long way behind where it will be in 5 years' time. And that's not only talking about what we're going to bring, hopefully, to the taco scene, but, you know, it's at a very, very nascent stage.
Mm.
So, for example, there is no one who's... there isn't a corn tortilla factory anywhere in the UK. In fact, there's only one in Europe, which is in Ireland.
Mm.
And, you know, absolutely key to a good taco, obviously, is a good tortilla.
Yeah.
And the fact that there isn't even anyone who produces a tortilla, or there's one person in the whole of Europe, just shows how far Europe is behind the States and, obviously, Mexico. It is all coming.
Yeah.
And whether we did it or not,
yeah,
it's about to happen because people are getting much, much more interested in Mexican food, and tacos, obviously, is a big part of that.
When Sam mentioned, you know, he's obviously been talking about this, you know, over the years, and I, you know, not having lived in Mexico, not, you know, I wasn't familiar with, you know, how fantastic, how delicious, how wonderful, you know, a good taco can be, and you know, we ate in lots of restaurants in London, and you know, and there was nothing, you know, wrong with any of the restaurants or the food, but I really struggled to kind of get excited about the whole project. And then, in fact, we travelled, you know, abroad. We were in New York, and my brothers went to Mexico, and you know, we went to numerous kind of, you know, taco restaurants out there. And again, I mean, it wasn't almost until the final day that we were out there that kind of we went somewhere where I said, "I get it now."
Where'd you go?
Tacos One in was it Chelsea Market?
Yeah, in New York was our best favourite thing.
Oh, okay.
In New York.
And you know, and then suddenly picking that taco up, eating it, I understood what, you know, why Sam was so excited about. Mm. You know, so I suppose that's my answer to.
And are you going to be making your own tortillas or finding a supplier?
Yeah, so we're making our own, exactly. So
I mean, obviously not tomorrow, but
no, but we're quite well on along the way. We've got our design for our little tortilla in-restaurant tortilla factory. We're negotiating with. Actually, it's quite a complicated business because a lot of the kit you need from Mexico is not EU compliant, and it runs on the wrong hertz, and there's all sorts of problems. But we think we've got a guy who's going to make it and change the electricity components of the things and retrofit certain safety items that we need from the UK. We found, you know, amazing fair trade corn suppliers, and so we're making good progress.
So what you did for the milk-fed kidney, you're going to do for the taco.
Exactly. We hope so.
So one last question is, please tell me about the napkin dispensers in Barrafina, because they're awesome and they're such a great design detail. Where did they come from?
I'm trying to think. You know,
but they're incredibly Spanish, is what it is. All those Spanish tapas bars, they have that pretty rubbish napkin.
It must have been Sam, actually, because, you know, I think because I, you know, I started off working for my dad in a Michelin-style restaurant with, you know, wonderful linen kind of napkins. You know, I'm sure I probably, you know, back then when we look at the design and, you know, and what kind of napkins were we going to have at Barrafina, I'm sure it took Sam, you know, quite a lot of, I took quite a lot of persuasion. But actually, of course, you know, in Spain, I think we did like that, you know, when you go into a bar in Spain and the floor, you're kind of knee deep in kind of, you know, it used to be cigarette butts and napkins. And so we quite like that spit and sawdust feel.
That's great. Well, thank you for making time. I appreciate it. Where can people find you? Where can they get information? Where can they, obviously there's no reservations, but where can they find the hours for everything?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously the Barrafina website is barrafina.co.uk. Quo Vadis is quovadissoho.co.uk. And the tacos, watch this space.
Okay, fair enough. Thanks for this. We're going to take a quick musical break, and we'll be back with the rest of Snacky Tunes. Welcome back. We have Street Smells live in the studio, and there's a lot of you. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Welcome.
Sorry about that.
Do you want to go around the room and just kind of yell your names out?
I'm Johnny Street on guitar.
I'm Vivi Street on drums.
Ryan Street on guitar.
I'm Lalo Street.
I'm Jesse Street on bass.
It's actually been a while since I've seen a band that's adopted the same last name. When did you, I mean, outside of me assuming that you're not all officially last name Street, where did you come to the decision to take the same last name?
Sometime during
the decision came to us.
I guess.
Street Smells.
Yeah, it's like a family band.
Yeah.
We do consider each other family for sure.
And what makes it a family band?
I guess when we practice, we kind of try to keep like a more laid back, chill out vibe where we just come, we'll eat food together, and then like I don't know.
Yeah. We'll sometimes hang cook, out, mid jam, and then
cook. Jam,
oh really?
Chill.
What do you who cooks?
These guys.
Oh, okay.
Johnny's
guy.
Yeah.
We kind of
have a very communal space where it's their home, but it's our practice room. A lot of other bands' practice rooms and a big kitchen.
What do you normally cook?
Hashes,
soup.
Yeah,
soups.
Gruels.
Anything you could just throw on and let chill.
Yeah.
Chili.
In the summer, tacos.
Yeah.
When the wood burning stove comes out. Yeah.
Really? Is there one like particular of the non-cooking member of the band's request? Like, hey, wouldn't it be great if you made that thing?
Ryan, you want to get this one?
I do. I request lasagna a lot because they make really good lasagna.
Oh, really? What's the secret?
I don't know.
No secret, just cheese, I guess.
It's actually just cheese. There's no noodles. We just feed you blocks of shredded cheese.
We
just melt cheese and perfect. I love it. Like just like grandma used to make it.
Yeah.
Is there any particular food that you feel like the one of the dishes you guys cooked that like really brought you together for the first time?
I think it was Roberta's Pizza.
Yeah, actually.
Oh, really?
Actually,
two blocks away from here.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we're like right down the street, so we would be like, what should we do? And then it was probably like a non-cooker's night.
On my night.
And we'd be like, pizza! And we'd run down here and get it, because it's so easy now.
Have any songs or writing come out over the meals, or like through help the creative process?
Yeah, we have a food album.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we haven't recorded yet, but it has all food names and.
Really? Look, what are some? I mean, we won't share with too many people, but what are some of the names?
Gingerbread,
Banana Famine.
Oh, Banana Famine is great.
Yeah, the album's called So Delicious.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, why don't we hear a song?
Okay.
What are you gonna play first?
We're gonna play Rapture of the Deep off of another forthcoming album called The Black Gospel.
Everybody seems good.
I feel like you guys sent over one of the best descriptors I've seen for a band, which is pajama jams. So I just, out of curiosity, it's your fault or is it just something that I want to ask about? Like, what qualifies as a pajama jams? Yeah. Well, inquiring minds would very much like to know.
Well, I think that's kind of like we're saying before, we all get together and jam. It's like
sometimes in our pajamas.
Sometimes it's Sunday.
Sometimes we're too lazy.
Maybe it's pajamas in real life. Maybe it's pajamas just like in our feeling, in our mind.
Like
it's
pajama.
Relaxed.
Very comfortable.
The hours go by and that's it.
So like pajama dance is potentially like a state of mind.
Yeah, it's kind of like a wardrobe and also a suit of mine.
Okay. Any particular strong pajama outfits?
Oh, we all have strong
pajamas. Yeah, what's like the pajama game like?
I mean, if you can have a matching suit, that's like preferable.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Like the top bottom.
Top bottom.
I've, got panda jams.
Our band room is a little hot for flannel. But
yeah.
Yeah. It gets really hot.
Yeah, but that's like a commitment to the look, right?
Yeah.
Any like butt flaps?
Union suits?
It's not that kind of
yeah.
bag, you
I would,
know what I mean?
I would love a union suit.
Wait, is that what they're actually called? I just always refer to them as butt flaps. Yeah. Oh.
We have Minnesotans in the house. So okay.
Cake outfits.
Warm.
Flapjack jammies.
Jammies. Pajama jammies.
Oh, okay. Hi, union suits. Now I know why I can't ever find it on Google. Now I'm really...
Right, Google search is way yeah, different than
like,
what you were
they're
thinking.
They're like, why did you get everybody this gift this year? It's like, well, I finally knew how to find it.
Yeah.
So you guys are currently recording a new... record.
Yeah.
What is the process? Is it like laying down track at once? Is it group jams, pajama jams in the studio? What's
yeah,
the vibe?
Yeah, we do a group pajama jam first, and then we overdub additional additional jams.
And is it a collective songwriting process?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And how did you? Oh, I mean, I have to ask, like, how did you all start making music together?
We started.
I mean, I know you're a family,
yeah,
but like
hanging out.
I've known John since like fifth grade.
Oh, okay.
And so we've always played music like our whole lives together since around seventh grade, and then we just started picking everybody up.
Yeah, we
way.
All kind of met playing in different bands and always appreciated each other's music. And then, yeah.
Are the other bands still active, or are they all?
Yes.
Some are. Yeah.
Which one? You want to shout them out?
What's still going?
We have Jay Maris, Prospector.
Lila comes from
Day
Roar,
Bad Girlfriend.
Yeah.
What's your new one? Triple Hex.
Lila's in Triple Hex. Yeah, I mean, we're always just kind of like jumping in and out of projects.
This is my family.
Yeah, this is her
first
band.
Yeah.
First
band. One is enough. And yeah, and you said Bad Girlfriend. Shout out to, what was it, like 2 years ago?
Yeah.
All right, well, let's get another pajama jam.
All right.
What's this one called?
Which one is this? Chocolate milk?
Chocolate milk.
Yeah,
this is called chocolate milk.
Okay. I mean, well done. Way to be, like, on point. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Across the sea.
Where is the smelliest street, and what's its name?
It's on the corner of Eldridge and Broom. That's what the band's named after. Yeah. Is down there when you go down. We used to hang out, or I guess just cruise the streets down there a while ago, and we were walking, and can't remember if it was like this street smells or this street smells. So there's no.
I'm surprised that it's not further down in like Chinatown, where like
I think they process fish.
Wait, Eldridge,
right there.
Eldridge and where
it's
though?
It's like Eldridge and Broom. It's like
That's
like by Vanessa's Dumplings, oh, yeah. Fontana's area.
Like,
and like
was it the summer? Was it hot out?
Oh my god! Yeah. It's just kind of all the time. Yeah. I think they process fish or something.
They just have their own recipe.
Yeah, nasty
combination
street
of
smells.
Bleach and
fish,
flowers.
You'd find information on our band, but you would also find an article
on that
about
street.
That street being smelly. So we're not alone on that.
Oh, so like, but that article was found
years after the band was made. Like, it was like a couple years.
Yeah.
We're like, these guys are onto something. Well,
yeah, people should really start talking about
that. Is that what the cultural zeitgeist is? Like, is that, like, something is definitely in the ether.
Yeah.
So I know that your EP Creamy, again, another great food thing, came out. How was the process of that, and how's it been having the record out?
It's good. Yeah.
It's
right. Cool. It's translucent red vinyl.
Oh.
Yeah, which is fun.
Such an exciting feeling.
Yeah.
How many conversations did you have about the right vinyl?
I don't know how we got the red one. One day we were just
we
like,
decided
ooh.
That it needed to look awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that there are bands' constant decisions like whatever, just put it out?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, maybe some aforementioned projects that are no longer part of the family.
Yeah.
But I mean, we want to put this next song. We want to put maybe some secret little treats and hidden stories in the next vinyl that we put out that we're recording now.
Like, do you remember that rumor that, like, a thing was, like, In Utero, if you took a razor blade and you, like, cut it a certain way, there was, like, another record hidden on that CD?
What?
Yeah.
I'm going to go to home and do that now.
Which I think was probably just, like, a way for record companies to get really dumb kids to, like, buy, like,
All right. I like that, though. We've got to put something like that on.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, the, like, Less Than Jake record where it had, like, the negative minute track beforehand, which you could go, like, backwards on your CD player. Like, it was digital technology that could hide all that stuff.
Yeah. So, Tool did a lot of that
negative
stuff.
Minute.
What did Tool do?
Tool would always have, like, their, like, albums, like, jump, like, up to, like, you'd be, like, there, and at the end of the thing, it'd be, like, count up to, like, 69 with 66, like, all this crazy stuff where you'd be, like, what's my thing doing? Like, what's my record player doing, or my CD player doing at home, where you're sitting there in bed, like, I'm just gonna go to bed now, and then you're like, what's happening?
Oh, yeah, they had that speech, like, something the King of the Carrot People or something like that was at the very end.
Yeah, or, like, a bunch of weird noises or something, you'd just be like, I'm never listening to this to go to bed again.
You're just gonna have to really deep on, like, what tricks you can do. I mean, it's vinyl, though. Like, do you have any ideas of what you can hide, or is it just more like an, there's big smiles that no one can see because it's radio.
Yeah.
When you nod and smile on the radio, I have to try. Translate.
We're going to make one side 14 inches and the other side is just going to be a 7-inch.
Two songs and a bunch of songs.
So I want to make sure that we have time to get one more song in because you guys really fuzz it out. But where can people find you, follow you, buy your EP, stay tuned for lasagna recipes?
We were lucky to get Street Smells Everything. So.
I can't believe that. I mean, before the article was written, in all fairness,
that's
so
true,
maybe
that
after
is.
That article, people were like, that's a great name.
Yeah.
But we got .com,
Instagram,
Facebook,
email. SoundCloud,
Bandcamps,
we talk about this all the time. Like, sometimes it's a great band name, but you kind of wonder, like, how in the history of music did, like, no one come up with, like, how did, like, some, like, weird, like, California, like, gutter punks, like, not be like, Street Smiles,
let's register and sell it to some
weird.
Same with Bad Girlfriend as well, too.
There was another one.
Oh, and then you fought them.
Yeah. They changed their name.
Oh, you did it with lawyers.
You guys kept just showing up at their houses with bats.
We would have shows and they were like, it's not, these girls look scary. Like, it's
not worth it. Oh, okay.
It's not worth it.
It's
not worth it. Don't bite.
It's not worth it. Yeah. They have the name for a reason. All right.
We have our name for a reason.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Really appreciate you coming in on this, like, Ominous. Well, I guess winter's finally here. Oh. Yeah, I know. Oh. Yeah, but that means that summer is coming. That's where they're looking at.
Yeah, there it is.
Yeah.
Last half full.
And so we're going to play a show pretty soon.
Okay.
On, what is it, the
9th?
Wednesday
the 9th. Okay. Awesome.
And then,
yeah, that's with the Major Leans, and then we play again.
Pajama jams. Oh, can you wear pajamas? Is that highly encouraged?
We are going to have a pajama jam shortly.
Do you do, like, for encores, like, you change into pajamas? Yeah. Yeah, or you're wearing just, like, Union Jacks underneath? Yeah. We can just stay long after. I've got a lot of pajama. Yeah.
The room's very cozy.
Yeah, it's right. All right, so what's the name of the last song?
Work in progress.
Yeah.
Syrian dream.
Syrian dream. Okay, great. All right, well, thanks for listening.
Say it's alright. talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.